Welcome back to the Mediocre Alaskan Podcast. I got Brandon Fifield on today. He is currently en route to Moose Camp, so I got to ask you a couple questions about that, but thanks for taking some time out of your drive for me.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. I know we've been trying to get hooked up to talk, and I was, you know, trying to carve out some time to do this, and I thought, well, you know, I'm driving for like 4 hours tonight headed north. I figured what better time than now. I'm cruising and I'm happening to be on my way to another hunting trip. So it worked out.
Yeah. We've talked about this a whole bunch all summer about there being so many things to do. It's hard to keep up. And so before we could recap your dull sheep, now you're already on a moose hunt.
Right. Yeah. I realized that was already a month ago. Going on a month ago. And it just feels like it was last week, man. It's been a whirlwind this year for sure.
Yeah. So I guess the starting point would be for your hunt was different than the hunt that Jack and Daniel went on. And when you guys were recapping your hunt, you mentioned a few times that you really need to have more time because it looked like things were maybe starting to heat up for them a little bit toward the end there. You went 10 full days, is that right?
Well, no, actually, this year's sheep hunt was about 5 days. And my initial plans was to do a full 2 week sheep scouting / moose hunting trip. And I think I mentioned that in our first conversation earlier this summer, which was going to be 10 full nights out in the woods. And I was really excited about that because I really think that if you can get, you know, 7 to 10 nights, you know, in a tent, you got time for bad weather, or maybe you just need a rest day, or maybe you have an injury or something you need to nurse for a day or two, things like that. I feel like you just need a little buffer. And yeah. That kind of blew up, and a buddy of mine's hunt flying in the Alaska Range, he was supposed to do, blew up because of COVID. His buddy ended up coming down with it, and anyway, so we kind of put together what was kind of a short, quick. We had 5 days, basically, to try and get out and make it happen. We went out to a spot not too far out of town, into the Talkeetna Range. And, we were able to actually put together one heck of a fun hunt.
Bang. I'm surprised. Dall sheep is such a funny thing because people are so unbelievably tight-lipped. I'm actually kind of surprised that you even mentioned what range it was. But then you're looking at such a massive range. Like, it doesn't really matter if you say, I was in these mountains. Like, good luck.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, you could say stuff like, oh, where'd you get that ram in the hills? Or where'd you get that moose in the woods? You know, you can be – I mean, look. As hunters, fishermen, we never want to give up our honey hole. We never want to talk about certain things. And obviously that's just the code. But at the same time, I mean, there's like four main mountain ranges, Wrangell's, Talkeetna's, Alaska Range, and the Brooks, that really support the majority of the sheep hunting in Alaska. So it's like, you know, all of them are pretty massive, have a lot of areas, and I'm not giving up anything. And to be honest, the Talkeetna Range is actually gotten really tough, Jeff. The rams and finding the mature sheep in there anymore is kind of few and far between. I'm sure there's some guys out there that know where they can find a ram almost every year, and kudos to them. But I got a taxidermist buddy, Tad Gilbert, Name Your Game Taxidermy, out of Eagle River, a great guy, hunting guide, taxidermist, been doing it forever, great friends with Meekins Air Service out in Sheep Mountain, and he told me the other day on the phone that he said the Talkeetna Range was done.
Oh wow.
And that there almost were no legal rams anymore. And so I thought, wow, I guess I must have got really, really lucky.
Mm-hmm. It's so hard. Again, we look at that, such a massive area, so it's hard to tell exactly, like, in any nook and cranny, something is probably going to survive. But, yeah, as far as, like, a real viable option, there are things that, you know, I'd heard about that, about the Kenai Peninsula, that, like, it's almost not even worth, like, is there a few around? Probably, but is it going to be worth your time to go down there and get up there and try to glass it, or would it be better to just try to go somewhere else?
Yeah, I think those areas used to be great in the 80s, 90s, definitely in the 60s, 70s. I mean, guys were getting on rams all the time back then. And, you know, with added hunting pressure, more of a popularity, I think, to sheep hunting, mountain hunting in general. And then we've had, over the last couple, 2 or 3 years, we've had some really, really hard winters in the northern, you know, well, it's just in the mountain areas, big snows, hard predation. We talked about that before, that takes a toll on these things. And like I said, on top of a lot of hunting pressure, guides, the pressure that they're under to get their clients sheep with the amount of money that they're charging, it all adds up for what is becoming, I think, a harder and harder harvest as far as trying to get a ram or get a doll sheep.
Yeah. Yeah, it's too bad. There are certain things that you look at and think, okay, this thing can bounce back. You look at herds of caribou and, you know, with good management, herds have just come back. But some of these animals that aren't able to reproduce on that same sort of level, you don't have a massive group of animals that can kind of protect each other and breed and grow and fluctuate like that. Like once a couple are out, then, you know, it's a whole different story. They're pretty careful about, they allow nanny hunting. They discourage it, but they know that if someone draws one of the tags down here in Southeast, if you do draw it, they want you to shoot a billy, but not nannies with kids. But you know, if you take a nanny out of the equation on accident, it's legal, but yeah, it just sets the whole thing back because you got these fragile groups and there's not a ton of them around. Yeah. It's a different different thing.
It is. I mean, I've heard stories. I got a buddy of mine that turned me on to the Brooks Range years ago, and he would go up in there and he'd say, oh, I saw 75 rams. I saw 20 legal. I saw 80, you know, rams. And I mean, this is now 10 plus years ago. And I used to think, man, wow, that must have just been big groups. And one hunt, we did see a huge, huge group of sheep. And I they were so far away, I couldn't tell you, you know, what was what. Just saw a lot of white spots moving around in a long, far distance. And now it's like, we went to that same area just last year and saw one sublegal ram in 7 days. I mean, it was like, so just to give you some perspective, you like you said, they're fragile. I mean, so when I went in and sealed my ram this year, I think it was like the 15th or 16th. I don't remember exactly what day it was, somewhere in that range. So I got it on Friday the 13th, so it had to be 2 or 3 days after. I mean, I went in there, and there was like 25 heads in that ADF&G sealing office in Anchorage.
Wow.
Where some guides had brought a bunch of sheep in from hunts. And this is just 6 or 7 days in from the opener, Jeff. Yeah. I mean, that's how many sheep had been taken out. And I thought, man, and again, I don't know the number, but a lot of sheep get taken out. And I kind of wonder sometimes, can the ecosystem sustain that kind of harvest? Like, they just get smacked every year.
Yeah. Well, and the things are so much better now as far as e-scouting, as far as, you know, like you said, also like the word getting out, the popularity. So if people are have the money, well, I'm going to go get a doll sheep, you know, just check it off the list if you have the money to be able to do that. And you're e-scouting and it's not like the old days where, you know, you had a guide who would take you up there. It's just so much easier, and it's still tough. But you know, even locals, like I would never have really thought about doll sheep, even though I'm an Alaska resident. In the last like 2 or 3 years, I'm like, dude, why would I not? Why would I not? Yeah. If for no other reason, then it would cost someone else $20,000, $25,000. Like, I got to do this because it's over the counter. I got to figure out.
Right. Exactly.
So, how many miles did you end up putting in to your hunt?
On foot or just in general?
That's another thing. There are certain areas where you can access with a motorized vehicle, right? And other areas that you can't?
So, in the previous years, in my sheep hunting experience, which is only, I think I've only been doing it for 6 or 7 years total, And it, after about 5 years, you kind of start feeling like you're kind of figuring things out a little bit. I won't say you're any kind of expert, but you've got a little bit of experience under your belt. Anyway, it's always been by foot, and we've on average put anywhere from 60 to 70 miles on our boots in a, you know, 6, 7, 8 day period. In this particular case, I actually took in a, I went in on a Razor on a side-by-side, and a really badass hopped up modified one that could get back in further than, you know, when the trail cut off, it was like, we still went back in another 7 miles. And, I don't think most people would have done that. I think the fact that I went with a very skilled and talented, individual in all facets of hunting and, you know, and it also was, you know, driving a side by side, knowing what it's capable of, pushing its limits in the past to know what we could do safely and how we could get into places. I mean, he got us into 5,000 foot elevation and we base camped with from that. And that alone was an absolute night and day difference from the other sheep hunts I've ever done, where it was backpacking in 12 miles just to get into an area, just to set up your first spike camp, you know. And here we had a side by side, a 4-man Cabela's Alaskan, a cooler full of Miller High Life and sandwiches, you know what I mean?
Yeah. It was yeah, when it was you can cool. Get back to, you're not home, but if you can get back to the boat, get back to the truck, get back to the whatever, and if it's closer, like, that's so rewarding.
And oh man,
so much yes. Nicer.
yeah, it's pretty
not
cool.
Even like, obviously, you know, having a side by side is huge, or someone that knows how to really use it and the access to that. But what about other things that you've really learned, and how important is it that, because like certain things that you can't really like teach yourself. Like, I'm a self-taught fly fisherman, right? You know, I'm kind of a self-taught deer hunter. You kind of go out, but it's a kind of a population-rich environment. It seems like dull sheep self-taught doesn't really go together. So how much have you leaned on what other people have shown you while you're out there with them?
You know, honestly, that's a really great question, and I'm trying to think how to answer it. That I haven't, other than this year, I hadn't really gone with a group or a guy that was like really experienced in it. I mean, I went for the first time with two other guys that was their first time. And then after that, it was with the same group of guys where it was our first year, then our second year, then our third year. And it wasn't until I think in 2018, I went with a buddy for like a 4-day trip, avid sheep hunter. He's got 20 or so under his belt. And it was another kind of 4-wheeler tent moose / sheep hunt where I learned a little, but we weren't really hardcore sheep hunting. So I picked up a few tricks from him. But, you know, the gentleman I went with this last time, Chad Arntz, Mountain Ops, he had so much experience in just patterning sheep. Okay, so there's an example right there. You just don't know how to do that until someone brings it to your attention, or maybe you've got experience with it in the past hunting other creatures, but sheep specifically are very much creatures of habit. They do the same thing in the morning and they're in the day and at night. And as far as bedding and feeding and moving around, and in particular this hunt, you know, we had 3 solid days in the mountains, and that's one thing I took from Chad in how we were doing our day to day. Was the patterning of the sheep that we were watching and how on it he was. He's like, okay, they're going to bed at this time. They're going to feed around this time, and they should be up moving around around this time. And I mean, he wasn't 30, 45 minutes off at every single time that he said that those animals were going to move around. And I thought, man, I've been doing that, but not to that degree. Mm-hmm. And that was one thing I really picked up. And another really, really, really big, feature that I think that I kind of just learned watching my other friends, and I think they picked up on things that I did, was the process of, and you can probably attest to this too, Jeff, the process of tearing a backpack apart to a full yard sale and packing it back up 6, 7, 8 times in a trip. And when you're trying to pack a lot of stuff in a smaller, you know, I mean, you probably have, a lot of us have a good size expedition style backpack, but me personally, I have a tendency to just pack that son of a bitch to the fullest.
Exactly.
It's really like not until the fourth day that I'm like, oh, that's how I should be packing this the whole time. And it changes every damn time, it seems like.
Yeah. So how long did it take you? Was this your first RAM or have you gotten more?
This was my second RAM.
Okay. So how many years did it take to get that first one?
It took me my fourth year. Okay. I got my first RAM. Yeah. Daniel and I both, actually.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I've thought about my first trip up there is going to be like the experience one. I'm fully expecting it taking, two, maybe three trips to get up there and actually get one. It kind of depends on who I go with and, who's available and who's really wanting to mentor, because some people want to do their own thing, especially with a sheep hunt. You know, you're going up there and you're putting yourself through it. So if you're taking someone else under your wing, you're either hoping for a double, either that or you're such a magnanimous person that you're just, oh, it's fine, I already got one, I'll let you shoot one and that will be my entire season.
Yeah. And then you kind of have to go into, and that was another thing Chad and I talked about, was, the sheep hunt experience in general should never be about killing a sheep, because it's really not an easy thing to do. It's you go in expecting you're going to go through this really tough deal, and then you're most likely going to come out of it empty-handed. I mean, that's kind of the expectation. And moving forward, I honestly, this hunt, I wasn't even supposed to take a sheep, Jeff. I was going with Chad. He wanted to take a sheep with his bow. And I thought, well, how cool would that be to be with him and be part of that and witness it and film it or something like that. And it just so happened he couldn't get in range close enough to shoot that ram. So I got the chance. And so I took it with my rifle. But I really feel like moving forward, I've got a relative and a really good friend of mine who really wants sheep. Just one. They just want one sheep under their belt before it's over. And I really, really, really can tell you if like, honestly, I want to go out with those guys and I want to get them a ram, and I have zero intention of shooting one. Yeah. I mean, I'll pay $2,500 to fly myself in and out just to go with them, help them, show them what I've learned and watch them do it and help them to succeed and or at least just have a good experience. And I really mean that. Do I want to take another ram someday? Yeah, hell yeah. But man, I really, really, really would be fine over the next couple of years if I could just see a couple more of my other buddies get the experience. And I would be happy to take the back seat and just be support.
Yeah, there has to be something else. If it's just about stacking antlers, at some point there's not going to be enough. They're not going to be big enough. There's not going to be the sheer number. Hearing Tyler Friel talk about his hunts, and that guy, unbelievable all the time. But you just hear him talk about the experience. It's the mental challenge, and he and the guys talking about it's so awesome. And then you have the people who can't help but always share. It's like the same stuff over and over again. Like, how many times are you gonna post this picture, man? Because it's just about antlers, points, and numbers. It's not about I can go up there, I can be totally happy. It was a camping trip. I got a buddy down here. Actually, two buddies down here. We've never killed anything together, which is kind of crazy. We start thinking, man, we've bear hunted, we've deer hunted, we've duck hunted. Well, I guess we got some sea ducks when we were duck hunting, but it really is just kind of being out there. And it sounds so cliche, and it sounds like something you say when you don't get anything. It's like, oh, it's just like getting out there. Yeah, that's just something that losers say. But no, there has to be. If there's not, it's not going to be worth it. There are not enough inches of antlers out there to satisfy this quest of more, more, more. No. It has to be something else.
Yeah, and I think it's important to emphasize that, as cliche as it may sound, because honestly, there is not enough animals to fill the bloodlust of the trophy hunter. Okay, and I say trophy hunter because I don't really like to say that I'm that, as much as I love to have the antlers or the horns or whatever on my wall. I love that. I love it. I look at them every day, whatever it is, a bear rug or a set of horns. I absolutely love them because it takes me back to the experience I had and went through to get it, right? And I know what it took. And honestly, there isn't enough sheep there isn't enough moose. There aren't enough deer. And I mean, of the class where a guy may have an unrealistic expectation of what he thinks he's going to get. And if you just are going to go out looking for points and horns and Boone and Crockett record book stuff, I mean, you're la la land, man. I mean, unless you've got money that you can burn or dump down the toilet, and you got, you know, the ability to get that guide that's been watching that animal or whatever, and you got that resource. I mean, I guess, but there is an unrealistic kind of like expectation or like what people think is out there. And you got it right. You said it. You want to come two or three times and hope maybe you get one. Mm-hmm. And then that's what it's going to take. At least, Jeff, it's going to at least take that many trips for you to have success, because there's so many variables and things that work against you to even have a chance to get something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. One of my first hunting trips was with a buddy on Prince of Wales, and we went up there and we both shot awesome 4 points. And then we went up again and the next year, same spot, and I was a little out of shape and I just got destroyed. And we just kind of laughed, and we camped and didn't get anything. And it was one of those hot days. And if you're blacktail hunting in the Alpine in August and it's really, really hot, you have until maybe like 8, 9 o'clock, and then it's pretty much over. And so it was like, it was like 9:30, 9:45. And he said, "Well, looks like it's over. That was a good hunt." And I thought, that was a good hunt? Like, we didn't get anything. And that was one of those, you know, you pick up those sort of attitudes and you're mentored by the people that you're with. And I thought, well, last time we were up here, we got 4 points. And now we're up here again. Like, why are we not shooting 4 points? But then, oh, it could still be a good hunt. And so having that in the emotional, mental arsenal is so key. Is so key, because then you're sacrificing to go on those. And I don't think a lot of people who spend a lot of money, it's not the same sacrifice. If you're the person who's been putting away, you know, 15, 20 grand over 10 years to do this hunt, you've sacrificed. So you're going to love the heck out of that trip, hopefully, unless it's just desperation at that point. But if there is a sacrifice and you have the right mindset, like just being up in that territory, and I can't wait. I am so excited to be able to do that at some point.
Yeah, I'm excited for you. And I know, you know, you've got enough time and hunts under your belt where, you know, I'm sure you know that a positive mental attitude is what you have to have all the time. And it is very difficult to maintain that. But it's about the second you let that go and you start letting despair set in and you start letting doubt and negativity start to leak into your mind, and all of a sudden it just becomes a cancer. It just spreads, and then all of a sudden you might start rubbing off negatively towards your teammate or your hunting mate. And you know, holding, and I've learned that as I've gotten older, like, you just never want to give up, because it's always just any given time something could happen. And sometimes it's just pure luck. You need luck to come your way. And if you just hold a positive attitude and a mental state of mind, most likely you're going to get luckier than when you're being a stick in the mud or a negative Nancy. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm one of those guys who, when things are miserable, I just need to be quiet and handle it. And I kind of get, like, the expression might look upset or whatever. Like, I'm willing to crack a joke, but I get in that focus sort of look. When I was I ran my first marathon in one of those rock and roll marathons in San Diego, and I got to like mile 18, and people like, cheering, you're almost there, and I just think I didn't say it, but I'm thinking, I'm not almost there, okay? I have 8 more miles to go. Like, 8 more miles is a long way. Do not tell me that I'm almost there, because I had to just get back into my mode, just deal with it. And that's kind of what I get when I'm packing out a deer or something like that. Just, I'm going to head down, I'm going to be quiet, and then going to handle it. But then, you know, you take a break, and you joke around a little bit, have some food and whatnot, but
no, it's a mental game. And sheep hunting, I think, I don't want to say sheep hunting. I feel like, and I've been telling the guys that, like, I really want to refrain from saying that word too much, because I feel like, again, it's just putting this, like, added pressure on I guess I like the more, say, reference mountain hunting, because it can be very similar. High alpine deer, goats, grizzly bears. I mean, you can go out and hunt grizzly bears in 6,000-7,000 feet, caribou 5,000-7,000 feet. You know, all those animals are all mountain dwelling creatures, and a mountain hunt is a mountain hunt. It's hard. It's mentally draining. It's physically draining. It's painful. It can be miserable at times, but it's also probably one of the most rewarding things that you can ever do physically in the outdoors. And I don't just mean harvesting an animal. I just mean leaving the vehicle or the plane or wherever, the truck, the boat, and then making it back in one piece and saying, man, I did that. I just did that. It's healthy. It's good for you. It makes you feel like you're living, and there's a purpose to you. And I would recommend anybody going out and doing something like that. It just is good for your soul.
Yeah. And it's not even like so that you can tell other people and prove it to other people. It's so powerful to prove it to yourself, to be able to say, I can overdo this. And that's where we get self-esteem and confidence. We don't get self-esteem and confidence from just sitting here and wait for people to give us, you know, compliments on social media. And that's one of the problems I think we have with people being so sad and depressed right now, is that we're not doing difficult things. There's a guy, I think Michael Easter was his name. He wrote a book called The Comfort Crisis. He's I think he's from either Men's Health or Outside or one of those. And he came up and he did a 3-week, 4-week caribou hunt. And he wrote the book about just how we have to do difficult things. And it's from those difficult things, these personal challenges, that we derive purpose and we derive self-esteem. And those things are so stinking important. And like it's good to feel kind of overwhelmed. I feel confident physically, but man, there's something different about the sheep hunt. I don't know what it is, just this mental sort of, I know I have what it takes, but it's gonna take digging deep. And I haven't down here, you know, getting to the top of these mountains, I don't have to really dig deep. I can slow down, you know, or we can, it's just a different program. We're not going 60 miles over a bunch of days, you know. It's kind of, you know, two nighter at most, you know, for the most part. It's get up the mountain, camp, hunt the next morning, nothing, come back, dry out. So it's kind of fun to be, maybe I guess a little bit intimidated by just how much different it is, but you have to do those things.
Yeah, there is a lot more to, you know, the physical side, like you mentioned, you're good there, and the mental, we talked about that. And there's a lot of like overcoming discomfort in terms of not like discomfort like my legs are burning or my feet hurt or my backpack's digging into my shoulders, but the discomfort of like maybe a scenario where you're kind of cruising side hill in some shale, or you know, you're walking a knife line that's, you know, maybe 4 or 5 foot wide, but it's got a 1,000-foot drop on either side, and it's 30 foot long or 30 yards long. And me, I'm honestly kind of scared of heights. Like I have a fear of heights. I always have had that. And getting up on the mountain helps me to kind of overcome that and like beat it, you know, and it feels good to like conquer that fear and discomfort. Like Chad, my guy Chad I went out with, man, he's just an animal. Fearless, very smart, very safe and calculated, not reckless and just mindlessly doing things unsafe. He thinks about it, and he plans his routes, and he was kind of the trail boss. I kind of just followed him, and physically he was just an animal, and you know, I had to try and keep up with him, but he was constantly challenging me, and not on purpose or trying to see what I was made of, just he was comfortable doing these certain things. And I was like, whew, man, I don't think if I was not with this guy, I would probably walk on this face or cruise on this cliff. But he showed me like, oh, well, when you get to this cliff, you can actually side hill down and around, or you can go up and over. And it kind of taught me like, you know, it's not over until you really kind of examine it and get your boots on it. And all of a sudden I'm thinking like, how many times have I turned back? Well, I can't make it up that, or that's impassable, where I could have done it. And now I never had a chance to go over there and look over that edge or into that bowl, or, you know, how many opportunities did I miss? And I really like, at the end, I thanked him. In fact, I gave him a big hug, and I was like, dude, thank you so much for just pushing me really to my limits and to making me realize that I'm okay. Everything I was doing was okay. You just had to overcome it and know you were okay and just be deliberate in everything you did to make sure you were safe. And I came out of it a better mountain hunter because of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really, really sad that physical challenges and these sort of things have been lumped in with like this toxic masculinity, as if like these sort of things are just outdated males who are trying to prove themselves. And that's just, it's just so sad and so wrong.
It is. It really is, man. And I do too. I feel like that there is like a you know what measuring contest it comes to like sheep hunting and talking about mountain hunting and, you know, the collection on my wall and the this, that, and the other. And you kind of get to that, mix it out when you go to these banquets and you kind of meet a guy and talk to him for a couple minutes. You're kind of like, yeah, okay, I kind of see where your mindset is. And then you run into the guy that's like-minded like you, where you're just like, man, I just love to get out in the mountains and get after it. And we kill something cool. If we don't, cool too, man. You know, and I'm just like, that's my person. That's my kind of guy. That's my kind of gal, whatever. And you're right. It is. It's negative. It's toxic. And it's not real, man. That's not what this is all about.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about the numbers and the, you know, I got these boots and this rifle and this pack. And, you know, I mean, it's just all of it is just kind of like this kind of like flex on each other thing. And I don't know. I ain't part of that.
Yeah, it's funny though. You know, as a content maker, you're a content maker. You guys are talking about tents and packs and stuff like that. There's such a difference in the delivery of it, which I think is so key. Because just because you own a Stone Glacier pack, or you're talking about a Stone Glacier tent or a Barney's pack, like it doesn't mean that you're looking to get stuff for free. Or you know, I got crispy boots. Oh. And, you know, you hashtag it. Like there are people who do that for sure. But there's also people who are just connecting and said, dude, this is a really good tent. If you're looking for a good tent, get this really good tent because these people know what they're doing. And I recommend it. Like there's such a difference, but it's such a subtle thing. And if you kind of got to know the people and get the benefit of the doubt, I guess. But yeah, there's some.
That's a good point.
You can sniff it out sometimes. It's the same thing with big time content makers. We've got Corey Jacobson has been on an elk hunt in Alaska and is posting pictures and, you know, well, he's one of those big, huge, whatever, but this guy is like, you just listen to him talk and he almost seems embarrassed by the attention. So he's doing this show, but like you can get the idea that this guy actually wants to educate people. He's trying to help people with this. And there's such a difference in the delivery.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a great point. I love that that wordage, embarrassed by the attention, because I mean, that's how I feel like. It's not trying to get attention. It's just sharing something that we love to do, or items that we love to use, such as boots or bags or packs or binos or whatever. And honestly, like most of us, we haven't had all the brands. None of these companies are sending us free stuff to go out and field test.
Yeah.
And we can really say, oh yeah, these Vortex Vipers are so much better than these Swarovski, this, that. Like, I just know what I use, or what I know because of what I use. And again, I've mentioned it before. I'm just a blue collar guy. I don't have money all over the place. I afford what I can and I make it work. And I imagine there's better stuff out there. And I'm not brand loyal really in any way. I really am just looking for deals and ultimately too, finding out if it works, it just works.
Yeah.
And you know, moving on.
Yeah. It is funny to see just not funny, but there's different layers of people in the industry and then the consumer layers, and people are just looking to jump on as soon as you start to do something a little bit different. That's really sad, because then we end up just not appreciating what the intent is. But it can be hard to tell what the difference is. Like, this person is buying all this stuff and trying to be an influencer, whereas, like you said, like these are the binos I have. This is why I like them. I have no real frame of reference, you know, because my previous pair was a $15 pair of Bushnells. But I like these because of this, and there hasn't been a moment in which I was like, dude, I wish they could do this. It was just Hey, I like them.
Yeah, exactly, man. That's funny. Yeah, I think most of us are in that position where we pretty much just know what we know from the stuff that we were able to afford to buy in that moment, or what was available at the sporting goods store. And, you know, and it worked, and you didn't see any reason to go and buy anything new. And yeah, and you're just, it's just the brand you bought. You didn't really, like, you know, you didn't have a loyalty to it by any means, you know?
Yeah. I was able to piece together a nice Sitka system. And then last purchase was the hoodie, or the puffy. Cause I'd got a first light puffy that was terrible. Like it was one of those, I guess, light puffies or something. Didn't have a hood. I hated it. So finally, after a couple of years, it was like from start to finish, took me like 4 years, but I got it assembled. So happy with the gear. But then, you know, down here with all the brush and, you know, coming down the mountains and whatnot, my Sitka pants tore. The rain pants, and then I patched them, and they tore again, and then finally on this last trip down, like, they just tore irreparably. I thought, well, I got to get something else. And then a friend of mine over on Prince of Wales, they had a renter who was a fisherman for a little bit doing some commercial fishing, and then he left a pair of bibs. Like, he washed out. He tried it once and quit, and then just left them there. And so I got these nice Grundens bibs, and for the wetness, man, it was perfect. Yeah. And that's what I wanted to actually replace them with. I was like, you know what? That thin light is nice, but that thin light, you are going to be wet. There's zero insulation. And so I was thinking about it, getting a pair of Grundens pants for wet alpine, and then also for rut too, because it's still super wet down here. We don't get those really cold snaps. So I was so happy that I got to replace my pants with these bibs that were stinking free. And
yeah.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't match because it's not Sitka, but gosh dang it, I'm so happy.
Yeah. Yeah, guess who's nice and dry and warm when they get back to camp?
Exactly. Yep. So how does your gear change from your sheep to your moose now? I'm sure some of the stuff is the same, but you got to be rocking waders, I would think.
Yeah, I do have like a kind of a gear shift. I have been fortunate enough. I've been very, very diligent and also frugal in my spending on equipment over the last like 10 years. I am a big Sitka gear fan. It's expensive stuff. A lot of it's Gore-Tex, which is tried and true. Love their camo designs. I'm actually a big customer of Camo Fire. I don't know if you've ever heard of Camo Fire. Mm-mm. It's a really cool website and app that you can purchase discounted overstock. Cryptic, First Light, Sitka, they sell Bose. I mean, they name it, check it out. They're really cool. CamelFire.com, awesome website. Obviously, I'm always looking to spend and purchase local with some of the stores, but, you know, you're buying a $300 set of rain pants, you'd love to get a deal on them, you know, even if it's 50, 60 bucks. It's like, again, I'm a caller, man. I don't got lots of money, so I got to be careful. So anyway, I do have a set of sheep gear that's all super lightweight. Like, I got the super light rain gear for the with the Optifade Sitka camo. I've got a little bit different, kind of lighter weight, warm base layers, different set of socks. I've got a puffy set of pants and jacket that I take sheep hunting. All that stuff got cleaned up, dried out, put away, and pretty much shifted over to my moose gear, which is going to be a little bit thicker, a little bit more brush resistant, because moose hunting, you're a lot more, you're in the alpine or in the brush, in the swamp, and the mountains, you're kind of just out in the open, right? So I do have, basically, because this trip is going to have a boat ride involved, it's going to have a Argo ride involved, and then from there, it's going to have a lot of hiking around. And, you know, swamp, you know, running around in the swamp. So I've got, you know, a pair of knee high boots, a pair of hip boots, a pair of mountain boots, and a pair of Crocs. So I'm taking four sets of footwear into one hunt. This kind of seems crazy, but it all gets used. I've got three sets of rain gear. Again, seems kind of crazy. Well, I've got a set of rain gear that I want to run in the boat, that I wear to camp in the Argo. And then, you know, usually that's kind of mucked up and nasty. I kind of hang it up, dry it out, put it away, and then I kind of have a little bit more like a day-to-day packable rain gear set that I can take up to the knob or wear if it's raining. And then if we get a moose down. If you've ever been part of a moose harvest, it's pretty messy. It's a lot of blood. It's a big animal. You can't help but kind of get blood all over your knees and thighs and stuff. So I actually put that rain gear back on. So I get that all bloody and mucky and nasty, get rid of it, hang it back up, and then I can wear my nice, clean, light rain gear where I might be in and out of the tent or touching equipment, not getting it all muddy and bloody and all that. And then I do have a thicker, puffy jacket, thicker, puffy pants, thicker socks, thicker base layer, a different hoodie, and a different kind of a soft shell jacket that I like to bring. And it also has different camo design that's a little bit more designed for more of like the subalpine, you know, 2,000-3,000 foot tree line kind of camo. So I've actually put this stuff together, kind of calculated in a way based on the surroundings that I hunt and wanting to kind of match that the best I could. And that gear is a complete mixture of First Light, Sitka, I got some Kuyu, I've got, oh, hell, I think I've got them all represented, to be honest, all the way down to some Cabela's stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I got it all mixed in. And, again, I'm not brand loyal. I just use what works to the application that fits good, that doesn't rub, that breathes right, that stays dry, stays warm, whatever it needs to do. I have tried it. If it doesn't work, I sell it. I put it in the closet. I give it away, whatever. And then I keep what works. And I've got shit that I've got for 10, 12 years, it's kind of tattered, but still works. And I've got some new stuff that I'm trying. So
nice.
I'm all over the place, and I definitely switch it up.
When you're on a moose hunt, you're talking about just kind of getting out some of these knobs to be able to look around. When you're e-scouting, yeah. Like a buddy and I, we had a moose trip all planned, and then it ended up falling through, which sucked. It was like 3 years ago, I think, maybe. You e-scout this stuff, like stuff looks great because you got these boggy looking areas that look very, very moosey, but because it is so flat in so many of these areas, like it's impossible to see anything because it's so thick and so flat. Like how do you, if there's not really a knob around there, or do you not even choose a spot that doesn't have a knob so that you can glass?
Yeah. The first year that we hunted the area we hunted, we never really found high country till the last couple days. And we were in the timber. We're in the swamp, in the timber, few, you know, elevated areas, never able to see any like miles away, but it was like, you just felt you like you were in a moosey area. And after days and days and days gone by, it was kind of like, well, shit, man, I think we're just going to have to get lucky here and be in the right place at the right time. And, you know, our calling wasn't real polished. We weren't real good at that yet. And we were just kind of learning, and we ended up, you know, stumbling across the small bowl and got one out of there, and you know, we're lucky and felt good about it. And it wasn't until the years after that we started to learn. But man, the area we're hunting now, we're really spoiled. We've got a camp that we stash in the woods, and we've got about a quarter of a mile hike from there that we can get up on a knob that's right at about 2700 foot, and it allows us to see about 5-6 miles away across several meadows in these big drainages that have these like tree line timber tree lines that run down these drainages, and the moose just kind of cross in and out back and forth of these things, and we can actually call them. Usually you see a couple, two or three bulls out there in the distance on a Monday, you can pretty much bank on by Friday something's coming up there if you get stay persistent with your calls. And that's what we've become accustomed to. And to answer your question, yeah, man, I feel like you need a vantage point, not need, but it is incredibly helpful and in going to vastly improve your odds, in my opinion, on finding something if you can see a little bit and get your call out there.
So my plan or my dream of just going up some river and floating down as I'm just gently going with the current, and then seeing a moose next to the river and rowing ashore real quick and shooting it, that it's not going to happen?
Oh, no, I think that's another great way, because, I mean, the cool thing about floating is you're covering territory.
Yeah.
You know, like where we're hunting, we're basically on a slope off of a mountainside and kind of limited to an area. Now, historically, it's held a lot of moose, and I think it's a breeding ground. And I think because we just happened to stumble across this thing years ago after many, many, many days and burn miles and broken four-wheelers and everything else of hunting and figuring it out, we finally found a cool spot. But I one of my first moose hunting books I ever read, I can't remember the name of it. It's about 12 years ago now. I should read it again. This guy wrote this awesome book, and he did all of his moose hunting floating. And I mean, he must have had, 80 kills under his belt with between himself and his clients. And they were strictly river float hunting, and they killed moose, bears, wolves. I mean, you name it. I don't know where they were. He never did say, but somewhere up in the interior someplace. And they had a lot of success. So by no means does that mean you're have less of a chance. I just feel like what we're doing in our style has worked. But there's other ways too. I mean, there's lots of other ways. And I think if you can just find an area that's got a good density and a nice herd, I think you got a good chance right there.
Yeah. My buddy that I was actually going to go on the hunt with the year before, he had planned on 10, 15, 16. It wasn't really big because he only had a couple days off. And so it wasn't a long float. And within the first quarter mile, or no, three quarters of a mile, it was within the first mile. Like, they went around the first corner and there was a moose and he shot it. So he was like, yep. Yeah, I could almost like row back up easier than to float the whole rest of the way. So that's where he kind of wanted to go. So that's a cool thing to be able to have the opportunity for that sort of success. But, I think there has to be a level of, it might be easy, but it probably won't. Because compared to a sheep hunt, you could be thinking that, oh, this is not a big deal. You just get put in a takeout, some rafts, and boom, you can just shoot a massive moose without having to do jack. But you can't get lulled into that, that is the program and that it will be successful, that they're everywhere.
Yeah. No, that's, I doubt that'll ever happen to that guy again. And that will be just a really awesome story he can tell. And the next one's going to be, the twilight hour of the last day, and they shot it 2.5 miles from the river through the swamp, and he doesn't ever want to moose hunt again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That seems to be what happens.
Yeah, he's in Anchorage now, and he did an over-the-counter doll sheep, like just weekend warrior type stuff, man. The guy is absolutely crazy. Super in shape and just loves that. But it seems like some people have a different connection with everything. Like, their instincts seem to work on like a different level.
Yes.
And he's a fishy guy, and he is a deery guy, and just everything. Just had a great attitude, works really hard. He just makes it happen.
He's a believer. Yeah. He believes in himself. He believes he's going to have success no matter what happens. I'm sure when it doesn't happen, he's good with it. And when it does happen, it's just the icing on the cake. And that mindset usually seems to bode well for success for that hunter. That's the end game with that.
Yeah. Once that doubt starts creeping in, then everything just starts to fall apart.
Oh man, it's hard to fight it. It's hard to fight it.
Yeah.
So hard.
So how long are you going to be out on this moose hunt?
This is going to be a total of 9 days. That starts pretty much today as we're leaving. Today, we plan to be back in Anchorage by Sunday of next week. Nice. We've got our logistics pretty dialed. We're pretty much going to have 5 or 6 nights in camp, I think, total. We've always felt like minimum we needed 5. That way we could, work our system with the calls and always believe that something's out there listening and going to come in. And I think, we're looking for about 5 to 6 nights out at camp. It's kind of a quick one. I like to really do these trips in 12 or 13 days to give us, 9 to 10 nights out in the woods. But with work, and I've already taken a lot of time off, this is kind of the way it went. And we'll do a quick turn and burn pretty much. Get back late next weekend and hopefully come out with a bull or two is the plan.
Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, man, I'm going to get started on a little bit of a snack here. I didn't bring a lunch to work today, so I always have some emergency food at school. But okay. I did another podcast this morning early, so I'm kind of dragging.
Nice. But, no worries. It didn't show at all.
So can you give me the little pitch for you for Alaska Wild Project and all that stuff?
Give you a pitch?
Yeah. People can find you. This is the second time that you've been on here, but remind folks of where you're at.
Definitely. Definitely. For anybody listening that hasn't heard, Alaska Wild Project is our podcast. Me, Danny Petrago, and Jack Lau. Find us at www.alaskawildproject.com. Check us out on Instagram, Facebook. We've got a lot of really great merchandise that's coming in soon. We've got some stuff right now that is about gone. We've got some really great events that we've got planned here for as the winter's approaching. And we've got some really cool stuff in the mix. We've got some great guests on the books here after the dust settles from all these hunting trips and everything. Check us out. You can find us anywhere you find your podcast. Obviously, you can get on our website and listen there as well. You can find anything you want on our website. And I just say check us out, man. We got a lot of really great things coming on, and we're excited and having fun. And we're 7 months in. We just moved our new studio over here this weekend, and so we got some more space, and we plan to do some pretty big things, man. So check us out.
Awesome. Love it. Yeah, there's just so much going on. I feel like I'm behind. I'm doing two podcasts a week, and I still can't even keep up.
Oh, you're doing great, man. And I'm stoked. I feel like you've I listened to you once or twice before we got ours started, and I could be wrong, but I feel like you've really ramped it up. Am I right?
Yeah, I've kind of checked into the game. Once you're doing something, you get to a certain point, like, well, am I going to do this, or am I just kind of doing this? And so I've kind of checked into the game a little bit more. And
half-stepping, right?
Yeah, to get after it. Well, I think it's also an important thing, too, is when you find people who, same thing with the hunt, you know, they kind of encourage you. And then being in contact with Tyler Friel and you guys, and being on your podcast and you guys being on my podcast, it just, as, you know, help each other, motivate each other, and, you know, compliment each other. Well, you guys got that area. I'm doing Southeast, but still talking. It's just very encouraging to have that connection with people.
Well, we're some of your biggest fans and some of your biggest supporters, Jeff. Just know that. We want you to be successful. We want to be successful. We want the whole podcast community, outdoor community, and all of us like-minded, passionate outdoors Alaskan wild lifestyle lovers. We all love this, and we all just want to support each other, man, and that's all that matters.
Absolutely. Well, that's a great send-off, man. Appreciate your time. Good luck on this float, and looking forward to seeing a nice recap.
All right, man. Yeah, you bet. I'll be in touch, brother.
Sounds good, man. Later.
Okay, take care, Jeff. See you later.